Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney with the club's Business and Leadership Forum. I'm your host for today's program, which is entitled, Why Are Democrats Embattled, and How Can They Win Again? We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Joan Williams. She was originally in conversation with Mary Cranston, who can't be here today due to the upcoming birth of her daughter's child. Apt moment, considering that Joan's focus is on family work life. Joan C. Williams, a prize-winning author and leading expert on work-family issues, is distinguished professor, 1066 Foundation Chair, and founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. Work-life law works with employers, employees, employment lawyers, unions, and public policymakers to increase workplace flexibility and eliminate discrimination against caregivers. Williams has authored or co-authored 6 books and over 70 academic articles, including Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Men and Class Matter, Unbending Gender, Why Family and Work Conflict, and What to Do About It. Her influential reports include One Sick Child Away from Being Fired, 3 Faces of Work-Family Conflict, and Improving Work-Life Fit in Hourly Jobs, an Underused Cost-Cutting Strategy in a Globalization World. Follow her on Huffington Post blog. Also, the Work-Life Law website is worklifelaw.org. Here's Joan.
I'm delighted to see so many old friends and new friends here today. And let's just all take a moment to wish Mary Cranston best wishes in her much more important activity that she's doing today. The proportion of the white working class who identified as Democrats fell from 60% to 40% between the mid-70s and the early 1990s. The percentage who voted Democratic in presidential elections fell absolutely precipitously in a similar period. And this trend has continued in recent elections. Workers who describe themselves as painters, furniture movers, servers, sewer repairmen were far more likely than professionals to report they were going to vote for George W. Bush. Obama lost big among working class whites with an 18% deficit, just about the same as Gore's was 4 years earlier. Now, the common explanation of this among progressives is crystallized in the book What's the Matter with Kansas? And it's really that Republicans have led these voters like sheep to vote against their own self-interest. I want to stop for a second and notice that the conventional wisdom is that these voters are really dim-witted. That's a conventional stereotype that privileged people have of blue-collar folks, namely that blue-collar people are less intelligent. And it's actually the kind of stereotype that working-class people notice. In Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter, I read just about every ethnography of white working-class people written since about 1970. And I also read a lot of the memoirs of what I call class migrants, people who were born working class, who have entered the professional managerial ranks. And what they report are open insults. Here's one comment. The stereotype of the Southern redneck as ignorant and lazy may be the last acceptable ethnic slur in polite society, said one class migrant. Another said, a liberal professor of mine who would never be caught dead uttering an ethnic slur regularly referred to trailer trash and white trash. You know, it didn't used to be this way. If you look at Coit Tower or at Rincon Center, at those wonderful WPA murals that we in San Francisco love so much, What you see is that white working class men were the center of the progressive imagination, and the hidden injuries of class were not very hidden. Think of Terry Malloy in On the Waterfront. I could have been a contender. We are invited to sympathize with a white working class man who is robbed of the talent that God gave him by the social position that he found himself in. Well, fast forward 20 years and you'll find Homer Simpson, who, as Wikipedia helpfully reminds us, embodies several American working class stereotypes. He is crude, overweight, incompetent, and a borderline alcoholic. You know, I think Homer's really funny too, but then so did whites watching minstrel shows. I felt in my bones that George W. Bush was going to win re-election. You remember the time that he fell off the sofa while he was drinking beer, watching a football game, and got a black eye? I thought, it's all over. Sure, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, but he did a really great job of messaging his respect and solidarity for working class people. So does Sarah Palin. Palin really only does one thing well, bless her heart, and that is channels class resentments. But that's all she needs to do well. For 30 years, this has been the rocket fuel that has brought Republicans into the majority. Democrats fall into the trap set by Republicans like Palin with unbelievable regularity. Remember when she wrote notes on her hand while she was giving a speech? And the president's press secretary the next day usefully made fun of her by writing notes on his hand and showing it to reporters. What the press secretary was doing was obligingly acting out the caricature of liberals that Richard Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, helped invent when he talked about pointy-headed liberals who belittle the intelligence of ordinary Americans. This is a strategy Kevin Phillips arguably forged, but Sarah Palin brings it to perfection. She mobilizes it into a political weapon, and what she mobilizes is what I call the class culture gap. Well, let's take a few steps back and set some backdrop. First of all, who are we talking about? For this purpose, I divide Americans into families into three groups. The poor are the bottom third, with a median income of $19,000. The professionals are the top 13%, with a median income of $148,000. What I'm focusing on is Americans who are neither rich nor poor, the missing middle, with a median income of $64,000. These are people who do the billing, do the nursing, have small businesses, sell auto parts, fix your dishwasher. Note that when I use the term working class, I'm not talking about the poor, which is typically what professionals do when they talk about the working class. I'm talking about these Americans who literally are in the middle. And also notice that many of us in the room who are upper middle class, who call ourselves upper middle class, we're not actually in the middle. We're the top 13%. People we call working class, they have one word name for us. They call us rich. So that's the first issue of, like, who calls who what and how I'm defining these locations. The second is really a question of why I focus on working class whites. And I do so because of the question I'm trying to answer, which is, how can the Democrats win? To quote political scientist not John Matteig, by and large, when Democrats win the White House, it corresponds to a greater number of white working class votes. Blacks never abandon the Democratic Party in large numbers, which is why the focus here is on working class whites. And yet, if we bridge the class culture gap in the ways I propose, we will deepen Democrats' appeal not only to African Americans, but also to Latinos, who are incredibly important upcoming demographic for Democrats, as you well know. Okay, so let's return to the class culture gap. The key to understanding it is to begin with a central dynamic, a class conflict within this group, within this missing middle, and that's between the felt distinction between hard living and settled families. Settled families are the people who work week after week, month after month, often at unrewarding jobs, and they hold themselves tightly onto a path of a middle-class life. Hanging in there is a key value. Quote, my father made a religion of responsibility, noted a class migrant whose father was a bricklayer. One misstep can slide these families into poverty, and they know it. So they value and they teach their children to value self-discipline, the discipline it takes to show up at a boring job, the discipline it takes to keep a stable family together, the discipline it takes to keep to the straight and narrow, using the tools that society provides for that purpose, religion and the military. A settled working class value is directness as a sign of personal integrity. Fancy talk they see as a class act and an enactment of class privilege. And of course, this presents a particular challenge for the golden-tongued Obama. Settled workers also value religion, religion and traditional morality. I always say they forgot to take Nietzsche in college. Whoops, they didn't go to college. And the irony so many of us see as a sign of sophistication, they just see as off-putting, as a flaunting of elite education. In other words, as an expression of class privilege. Remember Sarah Palin's insistence that she didn't go to an elite school and doesn't talk like elite people. That begins a description of the class culture gap, but it doesn't end it. The between workers and the professional managerial elite yawns a chasm in terms of how they experience everyday life. The elite values novel and exotic foods. Workers value comfort food and plenty of it. Think the difference between Chez Panisse and Red Lobster. The original title of the book, actually, which they made me change, was Obama Eats Arugula. Do you remember on the campaign trail when he was talking to people in Kansas about arugula and they quoted a nurse saying, I don't know, maybe it's some kind of Hawaiian food. The elites value education that that provide novelty and build up human capital. So they go to Europe or Costa Rica. Workers don't have the network to find that perfect little hotel in Paris or the funds to pay for it if they could find it. So they go to Vegas or Disney instead. All this helps explain why working class Americans resent the educated but admire the rich. Workers aspire to live the lives they were brought up to live, and with the tastes they already have, just with more money. They don't want to turn into the educated elite. That would feel like a betrayal, as class migrants often report. So workers want to own their own little business, and they admire people who have built big ones. That's why proposals to tax the rich just don't have political traction. I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm just saying we should understand how to message them, and that's not the way. Democrats fail to understand working class attitudes towards the poor as well as the rich. The settled working class tends to conflate hard living and poverty, and they conflate with a lack of self-discipline. The self-discipline, remember, that kept them on the straight and narrow. And so, for example, when Obama messaged healthcare reform as offering coverage for the 30 million uninsured, all the Republicans had to do was to turn to a well-worn theme, which is Democrats only care about the poor, and they're going to put their hand in your pocket to pay for benefits for the poor. Again, we walked right into it. Means-tested programs fuel class conflict because they pit the have-a-littles against the have-nots. And this plays out in very concrete ways. For example, 30% of the lowest-income American families get subsidized childcare. Almost none of the missing middle does. And so what they see is poor folks being provided free childcare when they're having to patch together their own childcare day after day after day. Now, the subsidies are erratic and they're unstable. That's not the point. The point is means-tested programs fuel that kind of class conflict. Economists will tell us that universal benefits are too expensive, but they overlook the fact that poverty programs exclude and alienate the working class. The final point concerns culture wars. which either are or are not quiescent, depending on, you know, day to day and whom you read. But they will rear up again, mark my words, because they're a key Republican strategy to use the class culture gap as a political weapon. And this is delicate, and it's difficult to hear, because it concerns values that we as progressives hold dear, values like abortion rights and gay marriage, chief among them. But my uncomfortable message is this. We do hold these as core values. But the working class, Black, white, and Latino, they do too. The dilemma is that our core values conflict with their core values. Now, the way we've handled this often so far is to say their core values are wrong. I just want to point out, and they are only held by ignorant people. They see that as another expression of class privilege and another mobilization of the stereotype that they're too dim-witted to know what really matters. I think what's going on is a lot more subtle. Take abortion. Now, first I want to say very, very clearly that I am an old-time feminist. For me, access to abortion is an absolutely unshakable ethical commitment. But I also want to acknowledge that particularly the way that abortion rights have often been messaged, they fuel class conflict. A central tenet of working class life is that the professional elite is obsessed with work, often to the detriment of family life. Now, I don't know why they think we're obsessed with work. If anybody, you know, I'd like to, maybe that will come up in questions and answer. What we see as vocation or ambition or diligence, they see as an obsession with social status. And so when they look at abortion, they see it as part of an overall and ethically troubling worship of work on the part of the professional elite when their working class ethics tell them that family should come first. Now, I don't know the answer, but I do know some starting points. Progressives need to be far more self-conscious about our class acts, about the way we enact class status, very unselfconsciously. This comes out in our references to food, in our references to leisure activities such as hunting, in our references to our vacations. Remember the flap over Michelle Obama's vacation? Class act. Class conflict. Many of these unself-conscious expressions of sophistication or everyday realities that we talk about so unself-consciously are seen by the working class, frankly, of all hues, as expressions and flaunting of our class privilege. They produce class conflict. They're frankly unworthy of us ethically, as progressives, and they also cause us to lose again and again and again, and I'm really tired of losing. Another principle, I think, is that Democrats need to choose universal programs over means-tested programs. And in this, we will have pushback from the economists who say, well, why should we give rich people benefits such as Social Security? Why don't we just translate Social Security into an anti-poverty targeted program? And the reason Republicans do that is because they know that that spells doom for any program. Look at the history of Social Security and Medicare compared to the history of welfare benefits, Head Start, and Medicaid. And that's why I almost fainted at one point when I heard the president talking about Medicaid. We need to defend Medicaid. As a progressive, I agree with you. We need to defend Medicaid. Do we choose to message that as defending Medicaid or Medicare? I think the path is clear. Again, means-tested programs fuel class conflict. And here I just remember a friend of mine who was teaching Head Start at the time, who was complaining about the mothers of the kids who she was taking care of. My friend was earning $12,000 a year at this point. And she said, they come in late. What do they care? They come in with shopping bags. She said, I have to pay $1 a minute for every minute I am late to pick up my kids. They don't. Now, again, I think it's really easy to caricature working class people, and it's a lot harder to really understand them where they live. But once we do that, I think we'll think twice about means-tested programs and to build the coalitions necessary to implement more universal programs such as those that have become the third rail of American politics because they work politically, such as Medicare and unemployment insurance and Social Security. We also need to stop assuming that bash the rich talk will win us votes. There actually is, of course, a lot of anger towards Wall Street. That's true. But the folks who I am talking about, and these are the non-unionized working class, the unionized working class actually thinks a lot more standard progressive ways. But on the other hand, and last time I looked, 92% of people who worked for private employers were not unionized, so that doesn't help. But the bash the rich talk, again, is often alienating to working class voters who admire people who built businesses and believe they've created jobs. I think that the way to retread that talk is to always connect bash the rich talk with the massive social redistribution from the poor, from the middle class to the rich that we've seen in the past 20 years. But you'll see, if you look at what politicians say, that's rarely done. We also need to think hard, and this is really the hardest one, about how to signal respect for our neighbors who disagree with us in the culture wars. And I think that's going to be hard for us as Democrats and hard for us as progressives. I mean, one hypothesis, and it's sort of a harsh conspiracy theory, is that the core of the Republican Party really only cares about economics, and they're willing to compromise on the cultural values to get the coalition they need to accomplish the economic goals. I actually think that describes the last 20 years, but you just take it as a hypothesis. Among progressives, we're kind of like the working class. We kind of think these things are ethical issues. Abortion, gay marriage, family values. We're not willing to compromise. But you know what? It's a question. Do we want to be in coalition with these folks or don't we? That's the only question. So I will stop there, and I look forward to questions.
At this point, I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club that the Business Leadership Forum and also on the radio that we are listening to Joan C. Williams, who's with us today on the subject of why are Democrats embattled and how can they win again? We'd like to take questions at this time. If you can please come up to this microphone, that would be great.
Hi. I would just like to ask, what role do you think education plays in some of these discrepancies in thinking? I'm not talking about the ethical issues like abortion, et cetera, but I'm talking about the economic parts, you know, of what really is happening with Social Security and why it's not a, you know, we should be doing one thing and not another. I mean, I think people just don't really understand the dynamic and the process, and how would you address that?
I mean, I think it's a complex question. First of all, I think one of the things that's confusing to Obama is that the African-American community actually values education more than the white community, if you look at it sociologically. And so he often assumes that access to education is the absolute Trump goal for everyone. I always think of this in terms of, I don't know how many people saw The Wire. You know, the season with the Eastern European women in the container and Frank, was it Sobotka?
Yes.
Frank Sobotka, you know what? He didn't want to be like me. No interest, zero. He wanted his son to have a working class life the way he had had. That was his goal. His goal was not access to education. And so one way education enters into this is that I think sometimes the Democrats forget that. That, for many of us, that's a class act. For Obama, I think that's a cross-racial gap. The other thing I heard you say, and this is something that I just frankly don't know about, but of course we have systematically defunded public education for the past 30 years. Some people say that this is part of a conscious Republican strategy to get a less informed electorate. I don't know if it's a conscious public strategy. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I know the result has been to get a less informed electorate. And that's a problem for us.
Yes, it is. I want to thank you for your highly informative remarks today. You are so rich in information, I feel the need to read what you have just told us. Is that available somewhere?
From your mouth to God's ears. The book is over there.
Okay. So what you said today is in the book.
It's all in the book, folks.
Oh, well, there's a good reason to pick it up then. Thank you.
My God, that was just a plant? I didn't plant her.
What do you make of the movement by certain governors to dismantle public employees' collective bargaining rights, and might this help Democrats?
The assault on unionization, as you know, has gone from the private sector to the public sector. Now, my best information is that in Wisconsin, there was a very conscious Republican strategy to try this out as a trial balloon to see if it was going to work. And there was a conscious decision as to who would take the political hit in if it didn't work, and there was an agreement that it would be the governor of Wisconsin. And I think the assumption on the part of progressives is, oh, this will be the, you know, now we'll really show that workers have to stand together and that this is an assault on assault by Republicans. And I think there is some of that. I mean, there have been a lot of demonstrations, as you know, in connection with Wisconsin. On the other hand, what I think it signals, and I think this is something that Democrats have completely not come to terms with, is an expression I always think of in terms of an African-American expression called crabs in a barrel, where if you get a lot of crabs in a barrel, what do they tend to do? They don't actually go shoulder to shoulder in solidarity and march out of the barrel together. They tend to rip each other up trying to get, as individuals, out of the barrel. I think it's really a divide and conquer strategy, and what I see the Republicans doing is saying, you've lost your health insurance. You don't have very many hours. Your husband got a pink slip. Why should they have all the privilege? Now, I think there are ways to counter that narrative, but I have to tell you, I don't think we're doing it very well.
Thank you so much. I thought, among many things, like I thought the discrepancy you show between these different segments of society is really highlighted. Mm-hmm. And so, to me, it seems like there's so much isolation in a lot of different segments of our society. So there is an ignorance on all of our parts of understanding other people. So what do we do? And do you think just sort of rebranding messages is enough? Or does it really take people from all segments of society being involved in the process?
I think it's such an astute question. The first time I ever gave a talk on this book was last year. And a friend of mine came up, sort of met me at the door as we were coming out, and she said, well, Joan, how can we change them? And I said to her, actually, what I'm saying is we need to change us. That's what I'm saying. And so I really appreciate your question, because what I'm really saying is that the Democrats won't regain a majority until the professional managerial elite stops ragging on the white working class. and stops the culture of this culture of insult that I started out talking about. I think that it should be a taboo. I don't actually know what to do about Homer Simpson because I totally love him, but I do think that there are deep cultural problems, and that I think of Norman Lear, for example, All in the Family, which was a famous show in the 1970s, and that was a real focal point. Before that, white working class men are the way you see them depicted in Rincon Center and Coit Tower. But with Archie Bunker, all of a sudden, white working class men were ignorant idiots, bigots. And so I do think that each one of us as progressives needs to think hard about how to change the culture of open insult against working class people. One is to notice that they exist, right? And if you look at the way progressive language is constructed, there's almost no way to talk about these people. Because when I talk to progressives about working class people, they assume I'm talking to the bottom third. They literally have erased these people. And I think that your question is so astute because you say, you know, what we notice. As progressives, we notice the poor. But you know what? Each person in this room comes into contact with working class people every single day. And the question is, do you notice them? Is how you treat them part of your notion of what it means to be an ethical person walking through the world? And I think those are some of the cultural changes that I so much appreciate the question, begin with us. And until we make those cultural changes, I think it's going to be an uphill battle in the electoral arena.
So I've read the book, and it's wonderful, and I'm delighted to be here and to hear your you comment on some of the highlights. I want to ask two questions. One is, what are your thoughts on whether affirmative action for working-class whites is part of the solution, for instance, in educational settings? It seems to me there's an increasing amount of attention, or at least maybe a resurgence in attention in the media, to the fact that working class and other economically unprivileged poor whites really don't get any nod in college admissions, and in particular in elite college admissions. So is that a part of the solution? And I guess if you care to say maybe more broadly, is there a role for law in a narrower sense? You're talking about law reform by changing our political coalition, but is there another role for law that you envisage in addressing the challenges to mobility for the white working class? Mm-hmm. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, this is a plant. This is my friend Lisa Pruitt. Her work is really, she's really doing unbelievably important path-breaking work about class, and is one of the leaders in talking about this in the Legal Academy. And she's not literally plant because she's asked me a really hard question, which is about affirmative action. I actually think, this is what I think about affirmative action. I think affirmative action should, people who are disadvantaged by class should be included in affirmative action. I also think that everybody who is disadvantaged by race should be included in affirmative action, and that includes privileged people of color as well as people of color who are not class privileged. Because the social psychologists, and this is extremely well documented, the social psychologists show that being, actually this is really cool, it's called a stereotype content map. And if you look at, there's a perceived trade-off between warmth and competence. And among the groups who are rated lowest in competence are working class whites. But if you look at that same stereotype content map, all blacks, for example, are disadvantaged by race. And that includes Barack Obama. That includes Michelle Obama, who is now listed by Forbes as the most powerful woman in the United States. But one of the reasons, people criticize Barack Obama a lot, and I do too, but the bottom line is the guy's options are really limited by race. So I do believe that there should be affirmative action for working class whites, but I also think that there should be affirmative action for all people of color, regardless of class. The second question that Lisa asked was about legal solutions. I think that the design. I think there are cultural solutions, as the young gentleman pointed out. I think there are design of public policy solutions. And one of those I've mentioned, which is a universal as opposed to means-tested programs. In terms of using litigation, although the Center for Work-Life Law has used litigation extremely effectively to gain rights for mothers, which is in the workplace, discrimination against mothers is actually the strongest form of gender discrimination. I actually don't think there is a big role for litigation because there is a big gaping hole in American law when it comes to class. It's part of the erasure of class, but it leaves us with few weapons.
So you alluded to this a little bit when you talked about how the culture wars were sort of, according to some conspiracy theorists, a shield for Republicans' economic strategies. And so they've claimed the mantle of small government and fiscal conservatism, but legislatively they do big things like making changes to Medicare and trying to end all federal abortion funding. To the progressive elite, that looks like hypocrisy, and it looks like how do you point out that hypocrisy without acting like or even thinking that everyone who doesn't see that is stupid?
I think that's a really, really good question. This is the what's a matter with Kansas point of like, don't these people get it? I actually think a lot of them do get it. I think they see exactly what the Republicans are doing, and I think they see exactly what we are doing, which doesn't look to them that different. I think that they see progressive elites as elites. I think that, in the Clintons, although, you know, in some level I'm a big Clinton fan, you look at the cultural affinities and the lifestyle of the Clintons, and what's a diff, right? What's a diff? And many of the policies Democrats have embraced look like, gee, who knew? There's a lot of influence from donors. And gee, what do those donors look like? They look really rich. And so as a heuristic, in order to avoid this, like, these people are so clueless, you know, my response is, yeah, they're clueless. We're clueless. People are clueless. This is like human nature. And when they look at us, the progressive elite, I don't think they see much difference in many ways. And this should sound resonant to progressives because it sounds like a far left critique of liberalism.
I'm going to change your profession for a moment, and I'm going to make you Obama's campaign strategist for these coming years. And would you talk about a couple of strategies that you would use in this upcoming campaign that would help him win on some of the things that you are talking about?
Okay, here's where having been a law professor for over 30 years should help me. We'll see if it does. So what are the... first of all, don't assume that the bash the rich language is immediately going to help. Don't assume by saying we're going to cut taxes on the fat cats is going to help drive voters into the Democratic arena, because the studies show that many Americans of whatever class who are not rich think they're going to be like just next year. And that's just part of American ideology. And so I see the Democrats doing is they are alienating potential donors through this bash the rich rhetoric, which actually isn't even working to bond less privileged people to them. So, you know, it worked great for Andrew Jackson, but it ain't 1830. That's one message I would take. And then that's such a hard question.
I'm going to take another question.
Yes, I believe that the top third of the people in this country consider themselves professionals. And we're talking about doctors, lawyers, so on, in which I bet a lot of us are. And these people do not consider that carpenters, plumbers, electricians, chefs, secretaries, so on, consider themselves to be professionals. And I think they resent it greatly.
Yeah.
Did you cover that at all in the book?
I mean, I think there's a lot of unselfconscious class privilege that goes around. I mean, even to professional managerial folks, these top 13% of American families, professional managerial families, median income of $148,000 a year, calling themselves middle class. I think that's really irritating to people who are actually in the middle, right? And if you read, you know, fancy sociologists, you will see that one of the characteristics of elites is that they spend an amazing amount of obsession worrying about which fraction of the elite they are in. That's one thing we should stop, right? Then what you suggest is, I would love to know where you got your figure that a third, the top third of American considers themselves as professional. There are a lot of class wars that are fought over that word, but if you look at the data, at least as I and Heather Boucher of the Center for American Progress cut it, it's really the professional managerial families are only the top 13%. So it's a much narrower group that most of us belong to than that we recognize. But I think, you know, and I feel quite hopeful about this, because I'll just tell an anecdote. I was in a cab, and this was a class migrant in the other direction. It was, I've forgotten what his original country was from, but he had been he was an educated person, and he was now driving a cab. And we had a long conversation. I'm a real big cab driver chatter. And we were talking about, you know, the dignity of work and the dignity of all work. And he said, I think maybe it was from India, actually, and he said that's one of the reasons he liked America, was because we had a different attitude towards the fundamental dignity of any job. And one of my sort of hobby horses is that I do not believe there is any such thing as an unskilled job. Hotel housekeepers, some of the most exploited and low-paid workers in this country, there's a lot of skill to doing that. Those ladies have to often, I heard recently at a union conference, make up 17 rooms a day. Do you know how heavy those beds are? Do you know how fast they have to work? And, you know, it's a small thing, and it's no replacement for real politics. But just respecting people's work, I think, is a good place to start.
Thank you. Very provocative and thought-provoking presentation. Question regarding your thesis and the emphasis on the working middle-class white population. The changing demographics of the country, the increasing Latinos, the increasing Asian population, you think your thesis applies equally to those groups? And conversely, because of the changing demographics, is it as important to be focusing on the things that you brought up regarding the white middle class?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for the question. I mean, for a long time, the conventional wisdom in the Democratic Party was, forget the right working class. They're a bunch of racists anyway. Let's get out the poverty vote and the single moms. And my reaction is like, how's that working for you? Have you seen those people's childcare situations and their job schedules? I mean, come on. Those people are trying to survive day to day. Also, I just think that's undignified for us as professionals to write off. I mean, you know, come on, we're white people. Are we going to write off other white people we won't deal with these white people because they're too racist. White people are racist. You heard it here. If you don't believe it, go take the implicit association test. Writing off a different group of white people because they're racist is just a simple expression of class privilege, white people. So in terms of the changing demographics point, I think that the class culture wars are going to get more acute, not less, and that's because of Latinos. And I think that we as Democrats have a real opportunity right here to blow it or win it, and that is with Latinos. But Latinos, I mean, I grew up partly in Latin America. They are pretty conservative. They are pretty conservative when it comes to these family values. And so I think certainly as a first step, caricaturing anyone who doesn't agree with us on these hot-button issues that we feel so very deeply about as simply ignorant, not wise. I don't think it's ethical either, but more to the point, it's just not wise. We will lose the Latinos.
As part of that answer, my question is, why is Sarah Palin so successful, and how can she be stopped?
You know, I actually have these sordid tastes. I really like Sarah Palin. I like her. I think she's brilliant. I mean, I gave a talk at the Kennedy School called Sarah Palin Plays Chess. I think she knows exactly how to mobilize class conflict in the United States. I think she knows exactly how to get the progressive elites to put their foot in their mouth. And I think the way to stop Sarah Palin is for us to stop being so stupid, frankly, and to stop falling into the same traps again and again and again and again. Because, you know, her playbook is not long. It's just effective. Who are the real Americans that she talks about? She's talking about the white working class. And one of the things that Lisa's work and others have shown is that class in the United States does have geographical dimensions. Now, I think it's important not to talk about this in terms of an urban-rural thing because, you know, we used to talk about race in terms of geography, like urban problems. These were not urban problems. These were racism problems. So I'm not eager to talk about this as an issue of geography, but there are geographical dimensions. And when you think about Sarah Palin's recent Alaska thing, you know, pointing out the hypocrisy, I just don't think works. God knows we tried. And I think that's because they think we're as hypocritical as the people they're watching. But I do think if we stop, we diffuse the moves in Palin's playbook by stop being so clueless about class, I think that she would lose her appeal. But she has high negatives anyway. I mean, you know, she has high negatives. She is Sarah Palin.
Hi. So I just wanted to go back to what you were saying about core values and how the progressives, you know, value ethics the most, and so do the white working class. And the only group that really is sort of cynical about ethics and, you know, focused on economics are the corporate aligned Republicans. And so I was wondering, but you also said that the core values of the political elite and the core values of the white working class are sort of diametrically opposed on many areas. And I wonder what you're thinking to, you know, what we should do to form a coalition when the values don't agree.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first step is to realize that we hold these things and we cherish these things. These are part of our identity. This is part of what we see as being an ethical human being. Only problem is, so do they. That just to go there, I think, is a tremendous important step. I can't tell you as a feminist how many times I've been in a room where people act as if the only people who are against abortion rights are just, you know, mindlessly patriarchal robots. It isn't true. There is a very strongly held pro-life position that is an ethical position. I completely don't agree with it, but I respect it as an ethical position. And I think, you know, people, it's actually part of the class culture gap, is white working class people are extremely attuned to being dissed. Actually, pretty much all disenfranchised people are extremely attuned to being dissed. You ever watch The Wire again, right? People get killed over being dissed. So I do think that people, that just the fact that we think this is an ignorant position is not something that other people don't see. Again, you know, we've met the enemy here, and at some level, she is us. Not the only enemy, but one of them, in terms of creating this dysfunctional politics that we all are so pained by.
Hi, thanks for coming. I've enjoyed your speech. My thoughts as you were speaking were towards class migration, and my thoughts are kind of working class families, specifically all working class families that have migrated. 20, 30 years ago, you could have a working class job, two people, a family, and have a home. You can't really have that anymore. And then with the emergence of minority groups having more middle class jobs and nonprofit groups to support kind of that climb from poor to working class, when we find white families that are perhaps dipping from the working class into the poverty, I don't really see many groups, nonprofits, programs in place for those communities, specifically for whites that have dipped and perhaps are in new areas or those that have been there for a long time. I was just kind of wondering what you think about the creation of programs like that without it seeming to be racist, because, as you said, a lot of white professionals don't really notice the less privileged white groups, and that's always kind of been a thought of mine. How can you create programs like this, have a lobby for these people, have a leadership for this group that many others conceive to be privileged as it is to begin with?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a good first step is to stop speaking of all whites as privileged. All whites are privileged, by the way. They're privileged by race. But you know what? Race ain't the only thing. Some whites are not privileged. They are subordinated by class. Now, in terms of program design, would I support a program aimed at whites to help whites who have dipped into out of the middle class? I wouldn't. I wouldn't both for, first of all, it's unconstitutional. That's a little problem. But I wouldn't support it even if it weren't unconstitutional, because I think when I look at the effects of deindustrialization in the United States and specifically of the recession, which is the most acute effects, it has had eviscerating effects on working class people. It has eviscerated the black working class. And that's what, again, am I obsessed with The Wire? That's what The Wire is about, right? It's eviscerated the white working class, too. It has just eviscerated the working class. And that, I mean, if that were at the center of Democrats' attention, people would notice. So I don't think it's useful. I mean, I'm focused on white working class here because a specific thing, those are the votes the Democrats lost. But in terms of forging programs, we have an incredible paucity of opportunity in this country. And that's the center of a real coalition.
At this point in the program, we have reached where there's time for only one more question. You can be it. And then we'll thank you for your
Hi. My question is about Roseanne Barr and whether or not you think that her caricature is missing from today's politics, and whether how much you think her being on TV in the 90s affected the Clinton administration, and what we can do to bring her back in certain ways.
Yeah, I think about, I didn't talk about Roseanne Barr, but I often do, because, you know, that show was one of the only shows that celebrates working class culture as smart, sassy, valuable. And I think it, you know, if you look at the history of popular culture, it stands out as an anomaly. And I don't know about bringing Rosie back. I'm for it. You're for it. We already have two. But in terms of creating a popular culture that celebrates different class cultures, that respects work of all varieties, that has a little bit of a critical edge on the professional managerial class. You know, who knows? Maybe we are obsessed with work. to the extent of family, worth considering. I do think that popular culture really is going to be a central part of this project. I think it's a personal project. I really hope everybody will leave the room thinking a little bit differently about how you walk around in everyday life. I think it's a project for popular culture, and I do think it's also a political project. So thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Again, we want to thank Joan C. Williams for her comments here today and remind that her books are here. You may want to explore over here. We also thank our audience here at the club as well as our radio audience. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.